The Business on RTE Radio 1 with AIB. It takes a certain kind of brave to run a business. We see it, we back it.
But anyway, to an interesting story that has caused mayhem in Britain and will lead to higher energy bills this winter. What do gas, electricity, wind, fertiliser, cattle and steel have in common? Well, electricity prices across the water have hit record highs this week because of rising gas prices and bills here are starting to go up. The prolonged winter this year led to higher gas consumption. Storage tanks that would normally be filled during the summer weren't, and the recent calm weather spell has impacted the ability of the wind energy sector in the UK to generate as much electricity. So gas prices have shot up massively and they've become so expensive that fertiliser factories, which use a lot of gas, have shut. CO2 is a byproduct of making fertiliser and it's used in the meat industry to stun animals before slaughter. The British government has held emergency talks with meat suppliers about shortages of CO2, with 60% of the CO2 supply cut. And even the steel industry has also been affected by these developments. So it's an extraordinary example of a domino effect in the world of business. Some people are blaming Vladimir Putin for not supplying enough gas to replenish stores in Europe as he builds the case for building a second Nord Stream gas pipeline to Europe. And it is an interesting story because it's about politics, gas, wind and weather all coming together. Well, my next guest is someone who sees the enormous potential of harnessing wind to avoid such problems in the future, if we can. Val Cummins heads up Emerald Floating Wind, a joint venture between Irish company Simply Blue Energy and Shell, which aims to develop a large floating wind farm off the Cork coast. Val's background is all about the sea, having spent her teenage years on board the Asgard. We'll get to that shortly. But first, Val, on the issue of wind, we've seen electricity prices in the UK hit a record high, despite the progress that they've made on wind energy when the wind doesn't blow. If we take out many traditional electricity plants, there's no guarantee that the wind's going to keep providing power.
This is the challenge of bringing renewables onto the grid and into the system, essentially, because you're quite right that the wind doesn't blow all the time and the sun isn't shining at night quite the way that it is during the day, for example. So we talk about the intermittency of renewables. And so what it is in terms of going forward, it's about designing a system such that you can have as much balancing as possible. And therefore, that's about getting a mix of renewables. So, for example, it's about offshore wind, onshore wind, wave, solar.
But even if we could reach that point at some point in the future, we're probably a long way off that. We would still need to retain traditional methods of generating electricity, gas or whatever else it is, wouldn't we? Because otherwise we can't depend on it.
You know, I think the bottom line is that we need to wean ourselves off fossil fuels. It's all about decisions now that will affect us into the future. For example, we go back to the foundation of the state and we look at the Ardna Crusha project. And for me, floating wind is the Ardna Crusha of the 21st century. So what we did in Ardna Crusha, we used a fifth of the budget of the state, of a new fledgling state at the time, to ensure that we could bring power to the citizens and power to the economy. And therefore, we powered Ireland.
Some people might say that this is something we need to do. It could bring enormous benefits. But unlike Ardna Crusha, Ardna Crusha was a state project funded by the state. Offshore projects like yourselves have big global backers like Shell, which, you know, who have very deep pockets. So the question is not so much whether we should do this or not, but it's about the mix of who should pay.
There's two things there. So why would you have a huge strategic partner like Shell? So first and foremost, in Simply Blue, we chose to partner with Shell on the Emerald project because we need the experience that the strategics bring and that Shell bring in relation to offshore oil and gas. Fundamentally, floating wind technology is bringing in technology in terms of floating oil and gas production platforms. Shell also have 20 years of experience in terms of offshore wind in the UK, and they have the bank balance to make the 2 billion type project work. For me, what we need government to do now is to pave the way. So it's less about billions of investment. It's about key policy enablers. Ideally, we need a target in the climate action plan that sends a signal for floating wind. We need a green hydrogen strategy. And finally, the port piece.
They're worried about
government
data.
Has a role across these areas, and this is about policy.
They're worried about data centres. They're worried that they may well end up using too much of the electricity that we generate. And that will be all fine if we had reached a stage where all this offshore wind was up and running and we were maybe even able to export electricity. But in the meantime, they're worried about that. And there have been a few crunch points in terms of demand.
Yeah, and I know that the data centre issue has become very topical, particularly in the last couple of months, because what we really are beginning to see is the huge demand for electricity that's coming from the new data centres that are being planned for Ireland. And certainly they're hugely important in terms of the economy, but they are hungry when it comes to demands for electricity. And I suppose I think it will be, instead of getting into the weeds, and it's important in terms of the debate around to data centre or not to data centre, let's look up and look out and say, well, what's the enabler here? And there's actually a win-win, the triple bottom line, win for environment, win for economy and win for society. If we can roll out floating wind this decade and scale it up next decade as a solution to some of those challenges.
As an offshore wind project, obviously it's about wind, but it's about the sea, it's about marine. Your own connections with the sea go back quite a long way. It's more than just an accident that you'd end up being involved with something that has to do with offshore.
Yeah, so I suppose...
When did that all start?
I know. I was talking to your researcher and she was taking me on a memory trip, actually, back to, I suppose, in sort of as a child, as a young girl. I was one of three sisters and my dad always had a punch on the River Lee, and I always loved going down to the river every winter when it would fill with rainwater and just being on the water, whether it was bailing out the boat in the freezing cold or just being by the sea. It was just always something that inspired me, and it always felt like a great place to be, whatever the conditions.
Bailing out the boat is a nice way of saying making sure we don't sink, isn't it?
It is. And in terms of, you know, that sort of boating experience when I was 16, and a real catalyst for me was signing on to go on the Asgard. Was just incredible. And, you know, just being at, on or in the water has just always been a comfortable place.
Just apply because it was something you were interested in. You just wrote to them, or how did that come about?
That's exactly it. In those good old days when you had a piece of paper and a biro, had a letter for the Department of Defence, who used to run the programme, had an address for there, and put a letter together saying I'm interested in this, and they sent on the programme, and I was working in Roche's Stores in Patrick Street as a part-time job at the time, and saved up my few quid and had an opportunity then to head off. The first trip was away out of Dunleary, heading over to the Scottish island of Islay, and just an extraordinary opportunity to be on board a boat. I had never had any experience like that. I didn't come from a sailing family.
Were your folks worried about you at all? Did they think it was safe?
Well, I remember the first time they saw me off in Dunleary, and the new trainees had to do an exercise called up and over. So you had to climb up the ladder, the rope ladder, up one side of the mast and go up over the top and down the other. And my mum was horrified, but I was a dab hand at it, and I guess I got it in the DNA. My father was a painter and decorator, so he was used to being up and down ladders all his life. And
that's my girl.
It was no problem for me. Yeah, that's my girl, exactly.
And a lot of camaraderie, I'd imagine, with the other trainees there. What was the group like?
It was absolutely inspiring. I mean, you'd have 20 trainees and 5 permanent crew on board. The trainees would never have met before, and it was long before...
Recipe for a mutiny there.
Well, potentially. It never quite materialised. The permanent crew were well able to handle us, in fairness to them. But long before diversity became such a topical issue as it is today, the Asgard was all about diversity, because what you had was a mishmash of teenagers from all kinds of backgrounds, those that had sailed and came from sailing families and were proficient in dinghies and everything else, through to young fellows. I remember sailing with
posh,
that.
Were they?
Well, and we'll come back to that, but through to the guys that, you know, were on board because they were on probation, and anything in between.
The sea became a theme because you went on to study marine geography?
Yes.
What is marine geography?
Yeah. So it was on the Asgard, I decided, sort of peering off into the sunset and the horizon at a young age, that I wanted to have a job and a career to do with the marine environment. But, you know, marine biology wasn't for me. I had a perception at the time that that was all about fish, and I wasn't sort of into fish. You know, the other alternative would have been go to sea as a mariner. So marine engineering and nautical science, for example, were on offer at the time in Cork Institute of Technology. But actually, geography was my passion. And I came across a course, a Bachelor of Science in Cardiff University, purely by accident, which was a marine geography degree. So off I set, and it was the best thing ever. It was a suited me perfectly, because what it was a mix of human geography, economic geography, environmental. So we looked at things like biological oceanography, all of these wonderful subjects.
You ended up having a very detailed relationship, shall we say, with periwinkles.
Yeah.
Detailed because you examined quite a lot of them.
I did. I came back to Cork, and after my first degree, I did a master's degree in University College Cork, my alma mater, for my master's. And I studied the distribution and abundance of the edible periwinkle Littorina littorea. And indeed, I collected thousands of samples and measured and sexed thousands of periwinkles. The whole idea was to look at the population dynamics, to try and understand whether the humble periwinkle was being overfished. In other words, you know, we had an unregulated industry, and we still do, for periwinkle harvesting at the time. And it would have been common back in the day, a lot of the time around the coastal areas, where you'd have had part-time fishermen or farmers or housewives would go out and they'd harvest periwinkles and sell them to a wholesaler as a way of kind of boosting their income. But there was a question as to whether this actually was going to run down stocks. The outcome of that was it wasn't the periwinkle that was in jeopardy, but in fact it was the periwinkle picker, because the profile and the sort of the profile of the periwinkle obviously was just a particular generation, a particular type, and not something that younger people were interested in at the time.
Did you eat many of them?
Never.
You didn't even taste one? No.
No, not after dissecting them the way I did. No.
Thousands of them dissected.
No appetite for them.
So how then did you go from that into the whole offshore area?
So I was very fortunate at a relatively young age. The centre where I did my master's research and went on also to do my PhD later on was called the Coastal and Marine Resources Centre. And I started to manage that at a relatively young age. We had a small team of about 8 researchers. And then we had funding from the philanthropist Lewis Luxman. And we moved the research station off campus down to the naval base in Hull Boland. And a few years later, within a few short years, we had about 40 postgrad and postdoc researchers doing all aspects of marine science.
The research centre in Hull Boland, that moved. It's no longer there, is it?
No, it isn't. It isn't. So it was actually back in 2008. I was going on maternity leave with my first daughter, Alva. And I remember my colleague saying, just go, stop worrying, and we'll only call you if the roof falls in. And literally a week later, I got a phone call to say, you better come down. And the roof was falling in. And unfortunately, there was a huge fire and that decimated the building and the research centre. But within a couple of days, the Navy had porta cabins in the car park. Everybody was regrouping. And a few short years later, I suppose what arose from that, the ashes, was the Beaufort building, which was putting together then all of the marine science and the marine engineering capability within UCC under one roof down in Ringaskiddy.
And that would have been a very old building. Was there any other older material that went up in the fire?
It was an old building. It was absolutely beautiful. It was an old stone warehouse right on the waterfront across from Cove. You'd sit in your office, you'd hear the tide lapping, you'd hear the bells of Cove Cathedral. And the building originally was constructed around the 1820s by convicts that came across from Spike Island at the time.
Right.
So we shared the building with the Navy. There was a naval archive piece, and unfortunately with an electrical fault, that was where the fire originated from,
and some of the old records would have gone. And would those have been from the 1820s on, those records?
To be honest, I don't know. I don't know the details of what were in the... They were military files, so
confidential. Top secret.
Absolutely.
We'll never know now. And just to go back to offshore wind energy, we have quite a bit of onshore wind, but it tends to be quite controversial because these turbines go into communities. Some people in the community are not happy about it. There has to be distance from where you live. People say it spoils the environment. And some people, I suppose, would argue that in some counties, we've got quite a lot of onshore wind turbines. Whereas, am I right in saying we don't have any offshore, or do we have a couple.
We have 7 offshore wind turbines off the Arklow Bank in the southeast coast. So Ireland was an early mover in terms of offshore wind back in the day in the early 2000s. It was one of the first countries in the world to develop offshore wind turbines. And then we did nothing.
Why did we focus on
the onshore wind piece.
Because it was cheaper? I mean, offshore wind, I'd imagine, is a lot more expensive to put these things out.
But the cost of that technology and the deployment of that technology at a pace meant that those costs came down quite quickly. The deployment of that technology, because it's relatively recent, is more expensive than the traditional fixed bottom technology. But the key point is that the perception that this is a futuristic technology and not for this decade is absolutely misplaced.
But if all of these offshore projects are going to cost billions or perhaps even tens of billions in total, and your own project, Emerald, how much would that cost to actually build out?
We're talking about an offshore wind farm in the order of magnitude of about 1 gigawatt.
That would be
about 2 billion in terms of capital costs. So it's not for the faint-hearted. We need the strategics to come in and help us invest.
Who pays the 2 billion? Do your backers pay the 2 billion? And then we all pay a higher public service obligation on renewable energy in order to pay back some of that 2 billion in higher charges. How does that work?
So absolutely, the bulk of the investment comes from industry. What we need is to get support into the renewable sector such that this floating wind opportunity can be accelerated in the decade ahead. And that does come with a price, and that price does materialise in terms of your energy bill for the consumer at the end of the day. But I suppose that the key point is we can't afford not to do it. What is the alternative? How are we going to meet our climate targets? How are we going to decarbonise? And it's not forever. We need to invest now. But the payback also, and we need to look at this from the point of view of a cost-benefit analysis, the payback then is in the jobs. It's in the jobs, particularly quality jobs in coastal communities in the long term. So a wind farm, once it's established, will be operational for a lifespan of about 25 years. It requires a huge amount of operations and maintenance. And there are jobs for coastal communities that, quite frankly, are bleeding now in terms of depopulation, really struggling for sustainability with regards to fishery sectors and so on.
If we import the turbines and all of that, are there many jobs in maintaining a wind farm that's floating 35 kilometres out?
That's a great question. So fundamentally, what a hard nut to crack will be how much of the manufacturing potential can Ireland Inc. achieve? In terms of manufacturing, we need a port and that type of ecosystem that is fit for purpose for that large scale industry. And certainly in terms of the foundations for these floating turbines, you know, there's a debate at the moment and a lot of work been done as to whether they might be made out of steel or concrete. If it's concrete and we look at Ireland, local supply chain, for example, can be developed along those lines. If we're not able to achieve the manufacturing of the foundations or the blades, there's still a huge part of the whole supply chain that Ireland can get involved in.
Well, Val Cummins, Managing Director of Emerald Floating Wind, thank you very much for joining us on the programme.
Pleasure. Thanks a million.